The Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. On the evening of Friday, April 14, 1865, during a production of Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., actor John Wilkes Booth shot President Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln died the next morning. As the nation soon learned, Lincoln's assassination was part of a larger plot to kill the top leaders of the United States government. And that story gave rise to many questions, some of which continue to be asked today, such as, how many people were involved? What were their motives? Were there larger forces behind the assassination? Dozens of books have been written in an attempt to answer these questions, including the latest such effort by our guest this week, Michael Kaufman. Following John Herron's conversation with Michael Kaufman, Fiona Beatty will tell us about a house museum that belonged to one of the conspirators in the Lincoln assassination, and Andrew Bacevich will conclude the program with his thoughts on the limits of presidential war powers. But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news. In what is still a little-known court case, about which you may hear much more before long, the ancestors of African Americans once enslaved by Native Americans are bringing suit to become tribal citizens. The case is being brought against the Cherokees in an attempt to overturn a tribal law of 1987 that bars those descendants from citizenship. But observers expect cases to be brought against the Creeks, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles, all of whom have similar laws. And if the slave descendants are successful, the impact could be significant. For example, today there are about 250,000 Cherokee citizens. If the courts overturn the tribe's 1987 law, 130,000 freedmen, as they are known, would become eligible for Cherokee citizenship. Although it's not known how many freedmen would actually apply for citizenship, if they did, they would gain access to health care through the Indian Health Service, tuition for higher education, mortgage assistance, and other benefits. Most of these services are financed through the Cherokee Nation by the federal government on a need-based formula, so federal funding would rise accordingly. However, fully 25% of the Cherokee national budget comes from other sources, like gambling, and the impact on this finite resource would be to spread it over a much larger population, thereby lessening its value to individual tribal members. The five tribes owned African American slaves. Some worked in large numbers on Native American-owned plantations, others alongside the owners of smaller farms and businesses. By the outbreak of the Civil War, the portion of slaves among the five tribes ranged from a low of 10% in the Creek Nation to a high of 18% among the Chickasaw. They were freed by treaty with the United States in 1866, and those treaties stipulated that the tribes adopt their ex-slaves as citizens. Decades later, however, the United States dissolved tribal governments, and when they were reconstituted during the 1970s, the citizenship stipulation was not, and laws passed soon thereafter barred descendants of those slaves from citizenship. The freedmen now want their day in court. Next up, John Herron discusses the assassination of Abraham Lincoln with Michael Kaufman. This is Talking History.
Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Many long years ago, many long years ago. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness, came out the wilderness. Old Abe Lincoln came out the wilderness many long years ago. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government, tore down the government, tore down the government. Old Jeff Davis tore down the government many long years ago.
Abraham Lincoln was the first American president to be assassinated. In time, there would be four, as well as seven other assassination attempts. None, not even that of John Kennedy, has proved more interesting to generations of historians and history buffs than the Lincoln murder. Such interested parties will be much pleased with the book written by our guest this week, Michael Kaufman, who will be interviewed by Talking History's John Herron.
In one of the defining moments of the 19th century, actor John Wilkes Booth shot President Abraham Lincoln at close range in a Washington theater. The story has become American lore. But as our guest this week illustrates, for all of the high drama surrounding this event, the Lincoln assassination also provides a fascinating glimpse into American society at its most turbulent, most divided. Here's Michael Kaufman, an independent political historian who has studied Booth and Lincoln for more than three decades. His latest book is American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies, published in 2004 by Random House. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we turn to the larger narrative, let me ask you about your interest in John Wilkes Booth. For you have not just investigated this story, but indeed tried to recreate it, even live parts of it.
That's right. My interest in Booth really sprang out of my interest in Lincoln and in the entire Civil War period. It's just one of those things that one thing leads to another, and I really felt that the story of the assassination had not been covered all that well. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized you can learn something new every day. You look in any direction, and you'll find families with histories and documents and photographs and things that no author had ever looked into. And that's what kept it exciting for me. It was a love of learning. It wasn't an obsession with this particular subject. It was just the fact that I could come from obscurity as a writer, researcher, historian, and really make some serious progress on this story that was so important in our history.
Well, let's turn to Booth. I mean, like many, I assume John Wilkes Booth was from the Deep South, a Confederate rebel from birth. But you present a different picture. Booth was, for example, from Maryland, right?
That's right. And most people don't realize it, but the Civil War was a lot more intense in some ways in the border states of Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware. That's where people really mixed North and South, I mean, within families, within neighborhoods and friendships, where people couldn't always tell who was on what side. And because the administration of Abraham Lincoln had dealt, I would say, pretty harshly with some of these, for understandable reasons, of course, but they had dealt with these people in a way that I think made them feel they were all being painted with the broad brush of treason. And so that kind of intensified things as well. If you were in Alabama or Vermont or someplace, you could all pretty much assume you knew where your neighbors were on certain issues. But in Maryland, that was always an open question, and that's one of the uncertainties that added a very, let's say, difficult dimension to that part of the story.
Right. I also think that part of the previous understanding of Booth was that he was a conflicted soul, a man torn between different allegiances. But that's not really accurate either.
I thought this was going to be a story about a person who was a traitor to one side and a savior to the other. And, you know, that whole dichotomy thing is what I had planned on the whole time. But it didn't turn out that way. Booth had so many levels of complexity to him, and he had generated those intentionally. When he formed his conspiracy, he did not really tell the people he had recruited what he was really up to. And that, to me, turned out to be the most fascinating part of the story, how he used the situation and used the laws, of all things, to shield himself from discovery of his plot against Lincoln.
At the heart of this narrative is the question of how could John Wilkes Booth, an accomplished actor, a poet, a romantic even, by many accounts a kind individual, become a murderer? Are there things that we can point to? Are there things that you discovered? How do we account for such a shift?
Well, I account for it by a couple of things. A deterioration in his personality caused, I think, by the stresses of war, by the slowly waning fortunes of the Confederacy, by the taunts of his friends and family who said, the Confederacy is going down the tubes and you haven't done a thing to help it. Those kinds of things, and the fact that he was no longer on stage because he had given up his theatrical career in order to conduct this plot against Lincoln, he wasn't getting that daily dose of adulation, you know, that he did as an actor, and he was extremely successful as an actor. So he was kind of going from day to day just being an ordinary person. He wasn't really used to that, and I think that all of that together kind of played on his sense that he wasn't really worth anything anymore unless he did this broad and bold stroke to save the Confederacy, or to save what he thought was the whole country, from Lincoln's tyranny.
Did he ever give a reason why he never enlisted? I mean, given those views, why not fight for the Confederacy?
A lot of people got on him about it, but I think the internal evidence supports what the public story of the Booth family was, and that is that he had promised his mother he would not join. She knew, and everyone in the family knew, that he was pro-Southern. He had at least one brother who was pro-Southern and one who was very strongly pro-Lincoln. And every time the family would get together, there'd be these horrible, horrible fights, and it just tore Mrs. Booth apart. And John was her favorite child, and he was always looking out for her welfare. And at some point, he had to promise her that he would do all that he could to hold down the family strife and not to do anything which would tear them apart even further, such as enlist in the army.
Well, Booth would hardly meet our definition of a radical, but as we've just discussed, his political views did, however, begin to change in the 1850s. Among the influences you cite in your book is John Brown and his raid on Harper's Ferry. How did Brown affect Booth?
Well, John Brown was, first of all, he had done something very decisive. He struck out for a cause that he believed in. And when his Harper's Ferry raid came along, John Wilkes Booth happened to be in Virginia. Remember, this was before West Virginia was created. And Booth happened to be in Richmond as an actor, and all anybody was talking about was going up to Harper's Ferry and capturing Brown, making sure he gets tried and hanged for his crimes, and so on. Well, Booth wanted to get in on that. He borrowed or bought a uniform from somebody and went with a militia unit up and stood guard at the trial and then at the hanging of John Brown. And it affected him very deeply because he learned a lot of lessons in following that trial in that case. He learned, for example, that Brown had not leveled with the people who supported him financially, that he had given them one seemingly humanitarian reason for doing what he was doing, but he didn't tell them, you know, he was out to cause a slave insurrection that would slaughter all white people in the South. I mean, he just never said that, or he wouldn't have had the kind of support that he did. And I think Booth took that lesson to heart when he formed his own conspiracy later on. One thing that Booth said all the time during the period of the war, every time he spoke of contributing or sacrificing to the cause, John Brown's name came up, and he said, you know, even though I disagreed with everything he was and everything that he did, he was a man who took action for his beliefs, and he died for his beliefs, and Booth really seemed to admire that.
Well, as Booth became, I guess we could say, increasingly frustrated by the events of the 1860s, it was Lincoln himself who became the target of his criticism. I think history has taught us to see Lincoln as a beloved president, but Booth was not necessarily unusual for his time. Lincoln was also a deeply despised president. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, when I was looking around for reactions to the assassination, I tried to find something somewhere where somebody had referred to John Wilkes Booth as a fanatic, and I couldn't find anything. That just amazed me because nowadays we all think of him as a fanatical Southern actor and all that half-crazed Southern sympathizer. But in his own day, everybody knew that the intensity of the war was just so great that fanatics were the norm, actually. And I guess it's all relative, but when John Wilkes Booth struck out against Lincoln, many, many people understood perfectly well what that was about, although that's a lesson we've kind of lost over the years.
Well, when Booth decided to act then, it shouldn't surprise us that Lincoln was his target. But the original idea was never murder, but kidnapping.
Well, I say in my book that I'm not really sure that Booth ever intended to kidnap Lincoln. He presented that to his prospective conspirators as the whole point of it. But the idea originally was to capture Lincoln and take him south and hold him as hostage so that his government would then resume its exchange of prisoners of war. And Booth was able to say that, you know, this is going to save thousands of lives because the Confederacy had this terrible PR problem with getting so many pictures out there of, we've all seen these Andersonville survivors. Of course, they look terrible.
Right,
like
right.
They're almost dead. And these things were making the rounds in 1864, and the South said it's because we don't have an exchange. We have to take care of these people, and we can't. So Booth said, okay, here's the deal. If we can capture Lincoln, we can force them to exchange, and this kind of atrocity will then go away. People will not starve to death. And you know, it sounded like a great humanitarian thing. But I couldn't help but notice that on January 18th, 1865, the POW exchange was resumed, and Booth's conspiracy continued without missing a beat. One of the conspirators happened to notice this, and when he called it to Booth's attention in front of the others, they ended up threatening to kill one another. Booth was determined not to give up his plot, even when his original plan had ceased to become viable, and he evolved his plan into something so completely unworkable that some of his conspirators left him, and others who hung in there were simply clinging to some very strange belief. I can't imagine what they were thinking. But anyway, I say that I'm not so sure Booth ever really intended to capture Lincoln, but this was something that he used to recruit people.
Well, even given the twists and turns in Booth's scheme to get Lincoln, the plan was still very complicated, calculated, planned to the smallest detail. I mean, you mentioned that Booth was a master conspirator.
Oh, it's just amazing how he manipulated people, how he got people he didn't trust to do things for him. He was a charmer. He was very good-looking, very famous. And at one point, he talked to a guy named John Matthews, who was a rookie actor at Ford's Theater. And he said, "We're going to capture the president in the theater, and we're going to take him out the back door after carrying him across the stage, and we want you to hold the door open for us." Well, of course, Matthews thought, "Oh, this is horrible. I can't have anything to do with this." And then Booth tried first, you know, intimidating him and calling him a coward and everything else. And at one point, he just quickly switched tactics and said, "You know what? I'm sorry. You're right. I shouldn't have put you on the spot. I'm terribly, terribly sorry about this." He goes, "Here's a peace offering." And he gave Matthews a beautiful black lacquered box, a long, thin box. He said, "I used to keep my theatrical swords in this, and I don't need it anymore. And you're an actor. You might need this." And Matthews walked away with this gift thinking, "Oh, what a nice guy he is." But the thing is, Booth had already made sure that four or five different people had seen him transport the arms for his conspiracy in that box. And, you know, John Matthews would later have a lot of questions to answer when it came to this conspiracy because he knew about it, he didn't report it, and you had all this other evidence, including written evidence in his own hand, which Booth had sort of cajoled out of him. And that's just the way that he operated against people he didn't trust. It's unbelievable how people have taken Booth's own word at face value, even though you can demonstrate pretty clearly when you follow him from day to day that what he was doing was lying and framing people he had no reason to trust. And that kind of became the central theme of my book, how he was really an actor all the way to the end, and fooling people, even his friends, into thinking he was something he really wasn't.
And perhaps he was even fooling himself, because in the days after Lincoln's murder, when Booth was on the run, you explain how he could catch glimpses of newspaper headlines, but then was shocked at the public reaction to his crime. Right? I think he expected praise.
That's right, because, you know, he had been going through 4 years where people had been writing editorials, even in the North, saying that Lincoln thinks he's Caesar. It's just too bad we don't have Brutus. And they had compared Lincoln to Caesar. They had said, you know, because Lincoln has declared martial law, he's a tyrant. He has usurped the authority of Congress. He's done this and that. He knows no bounds. And we've never had a president like this before. And he simply thinks he's above the law. Now, Booth has heard this in North, South, border states. He's heard it everywhere from decent, respectable people. And he thinks this is normal, that this is what everybody believes, except for a few corrupt individuals. And so when he killed Lincoln, he figured this is going to be obvious to everyone that they've now been liberated. And it just didn't turn out that way.
Well, John Wilkes Booth would never make it to trial, but many of his co-conspirators would. But it was kind of a strange military tribunal that was secret, some parts not secret. What was the setting of that military tribunal that led to the conviction of his co-conspirators?
Well, they had been having trials, I think something like 2,000 of them before this, as a matter of fact, and it had become somewhat normal. But the controversy never went away. These were civilians. These were people who felt that they were entitled to civilian trials. So when President Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, decided that this would be another military trial, you went through the usual round again of arguing for and against. The thing that made this even more controversial is that for the first couple of days, they took witnesses on the stand who testified in secret, and nobody could know who they were or what they said. This, in fact, was so distasteful to General Grant that he was one of the people who went up to Secretary of War Stanton and said, you know, what you're doing here is wrong. And so at that point, they opened up the testimony. Eventually, when it leaked out what those first couple of witnesses had said on the stand, it turns out that they were all coached, that they had perjured themselves, and the whole thing kind of blew up in the government's face, not within the courtroom because they didn't know that at the time, but out in the general public, everybody came to believe that the government had completely stacked the cards against the conspiracy suspects.
Well, this may not be a fair question, but is there an easy answer to why America is so fascinated with the Lincoln conspiracy?
Well, I think it's a mystery. You know, there are so many unanswered questions. There are so many levels of complexity to this story and so many different angles from which to look at it. And I think that's really the key. As long as you have something to talk about, you will keep on generating interest in something. Once you have all the answers and everybody's satisfied with your answers, we'll just move on and nobody's really going to take any further interest in the case. But I think that's it. I think it's really just a mystery that gives us something to talk about and argue about and keep us all thinking over this fascinating case.
Well, thank you, Michael. You have been listening to Michael Kaufman, author of American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies, published by Random House Books. This is Talking History.
One of the conspirators in the Lincoln assassination, about which we just heard, was Mary Surratt. Fiona Beatty is here to tell us about a house once owned by Surratt that is now a museum worth visiting.
Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme are some of the many herbs that Mary Surratt grew in the garden at her country home and tavern in Clinton, Maryland. A favorite watering hole and eatery for Southern sympathizers, Surratt House flourished until her husband died in 1862. Poor finances forced the widow to rent it out and move to Washington City, where she ran a boarding house. There she met John Wilkes Booth. The rest, as they say, is history. According to testimony, Mary Surratt provided weapons to the fleeing assassins on April 14, 1865, at Surratt House, an act that earned her the unenviable title of becoming the first woman to be executed in the United States. In 1976, Surratt House and Gardens were restored and open to the public. The museum presents a variety of programs focusing on 19th century life and the Lincoln conspiracy. Among them is a tour along the John Wilkes Booth escape route from Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. to Garrett's Farm, where he was killed. Virtual visitors will find further information on Mrs. Surratt, the conspiracy trial, the John Wilkes Booth family, and a recommended bibliography. Links to other nearby sites of historical interest include a Victorian herb garden, where visitors can learn more about medicinal and culinary herbs. The James O. Hall Research Center provides a searchable version of the catalog on the web. To find out more, go to surratt.org. That's double R and double T.
Hurrah for the choice of the nation, our chieftain so brave and so true. We'll go for the great reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. So up with our banner so glorious, the star-spangled red, white, and blue. We'll fight till our cause is victorious, for Lincoln and liberty too. They'll find what by felling and mauling our railmaker statesmen can do. For the people are everywhere calling for Lincoln and liberty too. Then up with our banners of the star-spangled red, white, and blue.
And finally, as promised, Andrew Bacevich concludes this week's show by providing some historical perspective on a topic very much in the news, presidential war powers. just what limits, if any, have been placed on the Commander-in-Chief in defending the nation. Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War.
In a post-9/11 world, what limits, if any, exist on the president's authority to use force? The Constitution addresses the matter with apparent clarity, assigning to Congress the authority to declare war. The exigencies of the Cold War all but nullified this provision. When it came to using force, presidents exercised wide discretion, ordering U.S. troops into action and notifying Congress after the fact. The legislative branch no longer declared war. It issued blank checks that the White House cashed at its convenience. After 9/11, the Bush administration wasted little time in expanding executive prerogatives even further. Acting in his capacity as Commander-in-Chief, President Bush committed the nation to open-ended war on a global scale. Concluding that eradicating terror meant going permanently on the offensive, he promulgated a doctrine of preventive war. Finding that Saddam Hussein posed a clear and present danger, he moved to implement this Bush doctrine in Iraq. On Capitol Hill, the response to this sweeping assertion of presidential authority fell somewhere between somnolent and supine. With the administration gearing up to invade Iraq, the Congress roused itself just long enough to instruct the president in October 2002 to, quote, defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq, end quote. As with Lyndon Johnson and the Tonkin Gulf resolution, Mr. Bush interpreted this as a mandate to wage war however he saw fit. Yet the brief history of America's global war on terror demonstrates the folly of allowing the executive branch a free hand. Deference to Mr. Bush's fixation with Saddam has cost the United States dearly. To expand that misadventure will only drive those costs higher.
You've been listening to Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.